tonight on Arena. Liam Cagney on Haunted Dance Hall at the National Concert Hall. Michael Dungan reviews Wexford Festival Opera and two more RTE Short Story Competition finalists. Welcome along to Monday Night's Arena, 51551. If you would like to text us tonight, please do. arena@rte.ie is the email address, and we're on Instagram at @rte_arena. This Saturday, the hallowed National Concert Hall will open up its doors and all of its spaces to the Haunted Dance Hall, featuring music that's electronic, experimental, ambient, and even classical. One of those taking part in the Silver Salon part of the day is Liam Cagney, an academic and musicologist, originally from Donegal, who's just published a book about the nightlife in his adopted home of Berlin, called Berghain Nights, A Journey Through Techno and Berlin Club Culture. And Liam Cagney joins me now from Berlin. Liam, welcome to Arena. For people who might not know, what is Berghain and why has it become such a symbol of Berlin's nightlife?
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me on. Berghain is kind of, I would say, for someone who's never heard of it, it's kind of like the Studio 54 of the 21st century. It's a huge techno club in a former thermal energy plant in East Berlin. And yeah, for the past 20 years or so, it's kind of been this strange mix of an underground club, but also the most famous kind of club in the world. People come here from all over to go there. And as to why they go, I guess it's kind of a Berlin anything goes type place, but it's also done on a very large scale. Kind of reminds me of someone coming from the classical scene that I used to write about. Kind of reminds me almost like an opera house to techno. Opens on midnight on a Saturday and it runs right through into Monday. So people come and go. Some people stay longer than they should. But yeah, it's a fascinating place in a lot of ways. And that was the subject of the book that I just published.
Because for people who've never been a part of that culture or maybe never experienced it, that whole idea of clubs that operate across entire weekends and places that never really shut, that seems slightly alien in terms of our own experience here.
It is indeed, and I would say that the alienness of it is part of the appeal. It's such a strange kind of sensation-laden place that it's really kind of interesting just in an artistic way. So, you know, what I came to realize after going there for years and being kind of fascinated with it is that it's kind of like an immersive artwork of sorts. The two owners put a lot of care into, you know, the architecture, the layout, the music, the lighting. It's this strange kind of uniquely German or Berlin mix of high and low. So it's, like I said, a techno club. So people go there to dance a lot and get sweaty. But at the same time, it's got on the walls, you know, Wolfgang Thielmann's artworks that are worth millions, the Turner Prize winner. So yeah, it is a bit alien, but in a way it's ahead of things. And I think it kind of encourages us to rethink what club culture is and maybe try and integrate it a bit into Ireland.
Let me scroll back a little bit. You grew up in Donegal and you studied musicology. You ended up in Berlin in 2016, if I had that right. Why Berlin? Why there?
Yeah, so I grew up in rural Donegal. I was kind of like a child of the rave era in a way. I was lucky enough to grow up in a household with three older siblings who were teenagers who were getting into, you know, early Prodigy and the Shaman and the Orb and Orbital and all that stuff. So I was exposed to that when I was a kid and I just sort of loved it, thought it was normal. I really liked as well the optimism of that whole era, and I write about it in the book. You know, the rave era in Ireland, it's worth a revisit because it was part of the general cultural optimism at the time. But then, yeah, I moved to Dublin, studied, played in bands, started going partying myself. And flash forward, yeah, quite a bit later, I did a musicology PhD, tried to get on the ladder as an academic in Ireland, kind of had enough of that after a while. And I went to Berlin and I'd been writing literary work for the past few years ahead of that. And I decided to write a literary book rather than an academic one. So that's what Berghain Nights is. It's kind of a fusion of a literary narrative with some academic research and interviews and so on.
Because Berlin is a place that maybe people aren't necessarily aware of it, that has attracted so many young Irish people for very, very different reasons, but a lot of them financially over the space of the last 15, 20 years.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's that period that I was talking about, Rick, I wasn't the only one who moved over at that time. You know, a lot of economic migrants moved to Berlin because it's pretty cheap to live there. I ended up living in this very bizarre place on the edge of the city because, you know, it was getting hard to get a place to rent back then. And I ended up living in this former Stasi base that had kind of been repurposed into a weird artistic squad of sorts. And it was that summer in 2016 that I went back to Berghain, having been there, you know, before, years earlier, and had this transformative experience then that led me to start going back more and more. And yeah, the club scene in Berlin goes back to, you know, a long time. People think of the Weimar era and cabaret and all of that. Then after the Berlin Wall came down, there were all these empty industrial spaces all around East Berlin, and a lot of kind of bohemian and countercultural types who'd been in West Berlin came over, and they just started turning them into clubs. And because of the licensing, they could stay open all night.
Maybe dig into that a little bit, because I'm fascinated by that kind of distinctive relationship that Berlin has with freedom and the night, if that's what you want to call it. Talk to me a little bit about how you see that coming from Berlin's history, and whether that's the last 100 years or whether that goes further back. What's that like?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rick. I'm not too sure. I would say, though, one distinctive part of the club scene in Berlin, and it's been like this all the time, is that they take it seriously. You know, it's not something that is just hedonism or just entertainment or just for students going out, you know, to get wrecked or whatever. It's taken seriously as a cultural experience. Even back in the early 90s, there were people kind of trying to write theoretical stuff about it. And like I said, a lot of artists getting inspired in clubs and so on. I was lucky enough to meet a lot of people while I was writing the book, people who were part of creating the scene here. One of them was Dmitri Hegemann. He founded the first techno club in Berlin called Tresor. And he said to me, clubs are incubators. And, you know, they're incubators for ideas, for meetings, for exchanges. There are thoughts that you can have in the middle of the night on a dance floor or sitting beside someone chatting that you couldn't have in the daylight in the outside world. And then, you know, you take it back out with you. So there is a lot of power in that. And I think we as Irish people have always known that. Might be time that we start to rethink what clubs are in Ireland as well.
It's really interesting. In the book, you talk about an experience that a lot of people might not necessarily connect with the idea of a club culture in Berlin. Describe dancing sober for hours on end as a kind of meditation. How did you come to experience that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite topics. So yeah, I kind of naturally was wondering, well, why am I getting up on Sunday mornings now and like making a packed lunch for myself and cycling down to the club? And, you know, it became integrated into my lifestyle in a way that was quite different from when I was in my 20s, when I'd go out with friends and it was, you know, a social thing. On reflecting on it, I realized, yeah, it was a kind of a meditation thing I was doing. I was dancing for hours to this very minimal hypnotic music in a very dark space, so kind of a sensory deprivation thing, and making this lateral body movement, you know, over and over. And then I would go home and I'd wake up on Monday feeling very refreshed. So it's kind of what I concluded about it. It ties in with the fact that around this time I realized I was autistic as well, and the sensory environment was kind of helpful for that. Funnily enough, a lot of the friends I've made at Berghain and within the club scene in Berlin are actually neurodivergent as well. So that's a whole other story. But yeah, it's part of the thing that I keep coming back to, reframing the narrative around clubbing. It's not just about hedonism. It's not just about, you know, entertainment. It's enriching in other ways.
You say that's a whole other story, but it's an interesting part of that story about learning that you were autistic while living in Berlin and about how that reframed your relationship with clubbing in general. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people, when I was a student, I was partying with my friends and I wouldn't even pay attention to who the DJ was or that kind of thing. And, you know, now I'm 40, basically, still going out. I'm going out more than ever, but I'm going out in the mornings and I'm going out in the afternoons. And yeah, I guess I'll put my musicologist hat on here, not to get too jargony, but I feel the dance floor is kind of like a non-semantic space in a way. It's somewhere where there's no need to speak or give an account of yourself. The language thing just kind of dissolves. Everything is just immersed in music, darkness, and visual impressions. And you can kind of communicate, you know, very gently, or if you want to, with people just on a very basic level like that. And for someone like me, neurodivergent, has to mask all the time in the everyday world, it's a real relief because it means you kind of you don't have to do that anymore. And yeah, I would say probably for a lot of people like me, neurodivergent, it's got the same thing.
It's about belonging as well, though, isn't it? Because there's this lovely idea that runs through the book that clubs can be places of belonging for people of all ages and not just, as we might consider in this country, people who are in their 20s or 30s or whatever.
Absolutely. You know, they say that in Berlin, it was on the dance floor that East and West first reunified after the Berlin Wall came down. And it goes back to the language thing, because on the dance floor, nobody could hear your accent. They didn't know where you were from. So it brought different people together. And that's kind of what you're saying, and which I agree with. People from different backgrounds, people of different types, different sexualities, gender expressions, kind of all mixed together. And so, not to be too utopian about it, there's still exclusions and hierarchies and privileges, but it can really, it can help make connections that you wouldn't otherwise make. I'm wary of coming across as too evangelical about it, but it's good. As long as, you're doing it the right way, I think it's good for health and well-being.
Talk to me about documenting a club and a community and a scene, because it might not necessarily seem as the easiest thing in the world to do, to capture Berlin's club culture in words.
Yeah, and one of the relevant things about Berghain and a lot of the other clubs, all of the other clubs now actually in Berlin, is that they have no photos policies. So you go in and your phone immediately has stickers put over the camera. So it's about preserving, especially in the case of Berghain, queer spaces. You know, people go there just to freedom of expressing themselves and being how they want. So you have to, if you're writing about it, then you have to kind of tread the line between, you want to bear witness to something, you want to record it, as literary writers, I guess, always have wanted to do, something culturally important. And at the same time, not prying, not being sensationalistic, and so on. So yeah, I wrote mostly about Berghain, and I wrote mostly about myself, because there were books about Berlin club culture and other club scenes before, obviously, but within the Berlin context, a lot of those books were journalistic or broad or trying to capture everything. I thought I'd go the opposite tack and just lean into how partial my account would be and just really focus on myself and what I was drawn to. And in so doing, then I hope to kind of chart a journey of kind of transformation to some extent. And belonging, absolutely. Trying to find other people who are maybe similar to you.
Does that mean that whole policy of, for instance, putting stickers over cameras on phones, does that mean people engage with their phones less in spaces like that they're more in the moment?
It depends. Some of us do. Some of us do. But we're all, we're all programmed. We're all robots with this stuff. It's sort of like a reflex. Certainly, it can irritate me if I'm dancing in the dance floor and somebody's scrolling through their Instagram stories. You still see that. And there's debates, as you'd imagine, within the scene, because there's one club in Berlin, at least, that takes the phone off you at the cloakroom. Which is great. And so people are saying, well, all of the clubs should have that policy. I think we're reaching, this is going off onto another topic, but I think we're reaching a saturation point now with social media and the version of the internet we've been given, especially with AI creeping in more and more. Kind of feels like we're just stepping into a banal AI space. So I do think there's going to be a reaction away from that. And in 2025, clubs that make you go away from your phone are a relief for people.
I think that is a different conversation. It's probably a very good one we could have on an entirely different night. But just to try and stick to this and finish up here, you've been exploring this club scene for quite some time now. What do you think you've learned about yourself? What do you think you've learned about what those kind of spaces can offer us?
When you go back to like the roots of techno in Detroit and black producers there, they were inspired by people like Parliament Funkadelic in the 70s, who were doing kind of futuristic funk music with electronic instruments, but also with a kind of a social critique. And one of the phrases from Parliament Funkadelic is about deprogramming yourself. And Detroit techno is the same thing, deprogramming yourself through this music from the dominant mainstream kind of way of thinking. I have reached the point where, I think that is really a potent part of the club experience. in terms of going somewhere like Berghain, this is a club that was founded by two gay men, and they fused what they had learned from the gay club scene with the techno scene. And so this is a club where, you know, heteronormative people are decenters. And part of the decoding is actually, yeah, getting away from that in my own context, probably learning a bit more about myself in terms of, you know, gender and sexuality. And yeah, the autism thing as well. Now where it's going is somewhere else, and it'll probably be another book going on to the topic of what you're talking about with the meditation. So yeah, we'll see where it goes afterwards.
Tell me a little bit about the event at the National Concert Hall and your part of that, because you're a small part of what is a huge day that's happening at the National Concert Hall. What can people expect?
Yeah, Haunted Dance Hall turns the National Concert Hall into just a kind of a funhouse of sorts for all sorts of adventurous progressive musics. And, you know, you said it there in your introduction, people like The Bug and Andy Stott are really big names in electronic dance music. People like Rush then from Ireland, one of our own, is doing this really interesting gothic folk music. There's kind of meditative jazz. There's, you know, spacey indie, all mixed together and in three different spaces within the NCH. So I think it's going to be a really fun way to experience music. Like I said, maybe that immersive thing to some extent as well. And I was really grateful to be asked and to be part of it for, by Una Mullally for her Sliver Salon queer writing series. And we'll be kicking off pretty early, 3:30 p.m. And yeah, it'll be my first time performing, if you like, at the National Concert Hall since I was in the Donegal Youth Orchestra at the age of about 15 or something like that.
You can't just drop. You can't just drop that and not mention what happened. What did you play? What was happening at the time?
I played second clarinet, or was I first clarinet by this stage? And we played the 1812 Overture. I think we played The Entertainer, and we played some Berlioz. And yeah, we were conducted by Jim Rafferty at that time. And actually, one other thing I want to squeeze in here, Rick. I actually had my first piece of fiction, literary work that I ever finished writing, broadcast on Arena years ago in 2013. You've got the short story competition going on now, and this one was run by Dave Lorden. It was called New Planet Cabaret, a kind of a flash fiction series. And yeah, it was a short story about a party, and it gave me a lot of confidence to have that broadcast. So it's nice to be on tonight again.
That is a wonderful way to tie all this up. Liam Cagney, thanks for joining us tonight on Arena. Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
Liam Cagney's book, Berghain Nights, A Journey Through Techno and Berlin Club Culture, is out now from Reaction Books, and you can also catch him at Haunted Dance Hall 2025, a multi-room sound world of ambient, experimental club and electroacoustic music this coming Saturday, the 25th of October. The full event runs from 3 to 11 at the National Concert Hall. And for more information, the website is nch.ie. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Myths and legends make up the theme of the 74th Wexford Festival Opera. It opened last Friday and runs until Saturday the 1st of November with its usual array of performances, operas, concerts, talks and free pop-up gigs. The annual centrepiece of the festival is a trio of main stage operas, usually lesser known works. This year they are Le Trouvère by Giuseppe Verdi from 1857, Deidamea by George Frederick Handel from 1741 and The Magic Fountain by Frederick Delius from 1895. Michael Dungan has been to see two of those operas for us, and he's with me now in studio. Michael, one of the wonderfully unique things about Wexford Festival Opera is that the programme always avoids the obvious. So we're going to start with Verdi on the festival's opening night, conducted by Marcus Bosch. It's Le Trouvère, which is the French version of Il Trovatore, but it's a bit more than translating the libretto, isn't it?
Yeah, and Il Trovatore would probably never be done in Wexford because it's far too mainstream. It's a big hit. But because there is a French version, that is the rarity. And that's what would attract the traditional Wexford audience. So they went for that. And as you say, it's not just about the fact that it was in French rather than Italian, but Parisian audiences required more music, particularly ballet dance music. and so Verdi obliged and found added to the revenue stream for that work by doing that.
Probably didn't call it that in those days. No. What's the story of Le Trouvère? Originally set in medieval Spain, so how does Ben Barnes, the director, adapt it?
It's the story of a troubadour in love with a noble woman who is also pursued by an army captain. And Ben Barnes, director, brings it up from, I think, 15th century Spain to 1930s Spain and the Civil War period. And the girl and the hero are Republicans, and the captain, of course, is a nationalist supporting Franco.
The bringing it forward to that particular period, it obviously brings an entirely different context to something like that, potentially a commentary on the 21st century complex?
Perhaps, and maybe Ben Barnes just wanted to leave it there. We see the costumes. At one point, there's newsreel footage projected during the ballet music, actually, the added music, and we see some of that. It doesn't go much further than that. It just leaves it there, and it all works extremely well, and it looks fantastic.
The Wexford Festival Opera, known for set and costume design for every production. So Liam Duna here on the former Matti Ulrich on the latter. How does it look as a show?
It looks very, very good. The staging, the sets are quite static, and then small changes yield big differences. And so we move from a cafe into a convent to a bedroom to the village square and so on with ease and not any fuss at all. The final act, I think, takes place entirely in it's like a court setting, but they're all ecclesiastical figures in it. There's a back row, looks like all cardinals, flanked on either side by rows of black-clad women, perhaps in mourning, wearing black scintillas. And it's very static, but the singing and the performances are so good that doesn't matter at all. It contributes to it, the stasis.
The performances, talk to me about those. American soprano Lydia Grindato, if I have that right, is Leonore, and Mexican tenor Eduardo Neave is Manrique, the troubadour of the title. What are those like as performances? Do they stand out for you?
Yeah, all good. All good sounding. The baritone a couple of times sounded a little tired in his very top register, but the three of them as a triangle all look youthful and credible. There's no stretching of the imagination for the three of them. All very good to listen to, including, as you say, the American soprano Lydia Grindato. The artistic director announced before the performance that it was kind of a very late decision whether she could sing or not. She'd been very ill. I heard that she had no voice the previous day, and she sang beautifully. I hope it didn't take her too long to recover. She has a couple of days now before she has to do it again.
Last but not least, the Gypsy Mother, sung by Ukrainian mezzo Ksenia Nikolaeva.
Yeah, as we'd say, the Gypsy Mother, who kind of drives the story. Her mother was burned at the stake, and before the opera begins, she commits an atrocity out of vengefulness and bitterness, and she still has that bitterness. It's the most colourful role, and the mezzo who sings her, Ksenia Nikolaeva, has an incredible range, very sweet upper register, and then when she gets down into the basement, she is like an angry bear. Very, very colourful, mad hair, great costume, kind of terrifying in a way, but she is a mother figure at the same time.
I did not, and we kind of skipped over almost the Comte Luna, the Georgian baritone, Georgi Lomaselli. He's a rival in battle, a rival in love. Is he a rival as a performer?
As a trio, they were all very, very good, very, very good to listen to. He understates his villainy, so he's not a pantomime villain by any means, but you still don't like him.
I'm going to move on to Didymea by Handel. The hero Achilles has to choose between destiny and love, premiered in 1741, but then had three performances and pretty much vanished until the 20th century. That's not the happiest of starts for any opera.
No, it was his last one, and Handel was already teetering on giving up on Italian opera, which had been his milk cow for decades, really. The audience for it was beginning to fade, and he found that it was easier to make money and keep people happy by writing English choral music, such as Messiah, which was the same year, 1741, and famously, of course, 1742, the year after Didymea, famously in Dublin.
The action takes place in the run-up to the Trojan War. Give us a little bit of context for what happens here in the opera.
Ulysses goes in search of recruits to bring to the Trojan War. And he's also looking out for the young Achilles, whose father doesn't want him to go to Troy and who hides him on an island where the king is his friend. The island is called Styros, and Ulysses and his men call in there to recruit, but also to try to find Achilles. Achilles is disguised, has been disguised the whole time he's been there, as a girl, this great champion, this great hero. It's kind of a modern story.
George Petru, he's the director. He's also the conductor in this. Tell us about his staging decisions. He creates two time periods at once on stage, so at least one of those is in the 21st century?
That's right. So I was a little fearful at this when the tourists first appeared, as if they had just got off the plane, and they come onto the beach and they're just behaving like tourists from anywhere going to Greece or to any of these sun destinations. And it's a little bit distracting and it's a little bit humorous. But gradually their behavior changes and has its own poignancy. And the two periods almost overlap at times. At one point, one of the characters finds a suitcase and opens it as she's singing, singing a part. And there is some overlap, and it all actually works. So it was a good calculation. Just some fears were appeased quickly.
And there's quite a bold, high-tech approach to parts of the production as well?
The projection designer, Armin Fries, as we were talking about earlier, just use technology that we're all used to, projections, animations, transparent screens, and so on, but so imaginatively that everything that he contributed added rather than distracted. So we have Didymea singing an aria while animated nightingales are floating above her, and she tries to interact with them. And then they are pursued by hunters from a Grecian urn. The exact same character is like a double Keats reference in one shot. Clouds are shown, kind of roiling clouds, an underwater scene, and it all works extremely well. It's modern deus ex machina. Fantastic.
In Handel's day, the young cross-dressing Achilles would have been sung by castrato. But tell us a little bit about the Brazilian male soprano Bruno de Sá, who sings the role in this particular production.
Okay, extraordinary. Like, soprano, and not just soprano, but coloratura soprano. Very high, very vocally acrobatic and flawless and apparently effortless. In many ways, he steals the stage, and he's also so comfortable with either a masculine persona and a feminine persona, because he's been disguised as a girl all this time, and he just relishes showing off in both very, very effectively, and extremely charismatic performer. Happily, we don't have castrati anymore, but Wexford found this guy, and he's spectacular.
Belgian soprano Sophie Juncker, she sings the title role. What was her performance like for you?
So Bruno de Sade, who you mentioned, and Nicola Balducci, the countertenor, also a very high voicemail. The three of them are wonderful. And the two men are just marvels really of what the male voice can do. But if I had to spend an evening just listening to one voice, it would be to hers. There's an extra layer of beauty to it. And I suppose Handel gives her more of an emotional range than he does to the other two. And she can do tenderness, she can do grief, she can do anger. It's just an incredible trio of singers.
What's the atmosphere like at the festival this year? Because frequently that's what people talk about when they go to see a production of one kind or another and then come back.
So I was down an opening night, so that's a little bit extra special. There's kind of a gala atmosphere there. There's lots of people from outside Ireland, which there will be throughout the festival, but they have made an extra effort to be there on the first night. From people I chatted to during the intervals and here and there and in the town over the weekend, there's a great atmosphere. There generally is. I was talking about the opening night last year here also, not as successful, but people were abuzz about the Verdi on Saturday and on Sunday, even more so about the Handel.
So when it comes to La Trouvère and Didamea, they're performing on selected dates throughout the festival,
That's right.
Of which I think are sold out at this point anyway, but it sounds like you're recommending both of them.
I'm recommending both. I'd love to hear the Handel again. And it's just such a nice story that something that was an utter flop, and they got three performances, has been resuscitated and went down so well.
Michael Dungan, thank you for talking to us.
Thanks,
tonight,
Rich.
On Arena. The 74th Wexford Festival Opera runs until the 1st of November. There are, from what I could see earlier on, a handful of tickets still available at wexfordopera.com. We're going to finish with some music because it would seem a shame to tease you and not give you a little something. This is from Le Trouvère. It's from Act 2, Scene 7. It's Au Ciel Manrique. And this is the Orchestra El Coro del Teatro Comunale de Bologna, performed by Roberta Mantegna as Leonora and conducted by Roberto Abbado. That is Roberta Mantegna singing the role of Leonora, and that was conducted by Roberto Abbado. I've got to ask if Marty was there and enjoying himself. Of course he was. This Friday, the winner of this year's RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus will be announced live here on Arena. We'll be coming to you from the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleira with an evening of brilliant music, live readings and interviews. You can listen live on Radio 1 on the night, of course, but there's an opportunity to be part of the whole theatre atmosphere. Audience tickets are now available at paviliontheatre.ie. Now, as I've already mentioned on the show, one shortlisted story is being broadcast every night on Late Date at 11:20 here on RTE Radio 1. Last week, we spoke with some of the shortlisted story writers. This evening, I'm delighted to say that Ian Feary and Jill Kenny are also joining us. You're both very welcome to Arena.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Thanks very much, Rick.
Ian, I'm going to start with you. Tell us a little bit about your story and what it's about.
Yeah, this story is about a 9-year-old girl called Ivy. She lives with her mum and her dad and her older sister. It's hinted that her older sister may have additional needs. And Ivy goes out on a girly day with her auntie Kira. They go shopping. They have a meal in a restaurant. But something isn't right. There's a bit of tension. Auntie Kira is very upset and Ivy feels responsible.
Let's have a listen to a little piece of that. Your story is called Auntie and Anto and Ivy and Ava, and it's by Ian Feary. This is read by Ebby O'Toole at Champong.
Mam is hugging Auntie Kira in the sitting room, making the same sort of sounds she makes when she's trying to get Ava to calm down. Auntie Kira jumps back when she sees me and gives me a sniffly, no-makeup smile. "There's my rocker chick," she says. "I was thinking we go round the shops, maybe get some burgers and milkshakes. A girly girl day, what you think?" "Sounds brilliant," I say. "Well, you're paying, so bring your purse." I run back up to my room for my shoulder bag and the denim jacket Auntie Ciara gave me for my 9th birthday. I haven't worn the jacket since the sleepover, and putting it on gives me a funny feeling in my belly. Dad catches me on my way back downstairs and puts 20 euro in my bag. "You pay for lunch, all right?" he says quietly. I roll my eyes. Dad, Auntie Ciara wasn't actually being serious about me paying. "Well, maybe get your big sister a teddy or something in the shops. She doesn't get to go out for the girly days like you." "Ava won't like a new teddy," I say as we go down. "She only likes Nunu."
It's a fairly big smile, Ian. Is that the first time you've heard that?
What a privilege to hear that, being read by such an accomplished actor as well. It's just a real, real privilege to hear that. I didn't know what to expect. I did a bit of online stalking when I heard that Evie O'Toole Chengfong was the narrator. So I was listening to hear what her voice was like, and that's exactly what I wanted. Kind of a Dublin kind of voice. It's brilliant.
Jill, you're joining us not here in studio, but from a cottage beside an ancient oak wood in County Tipperary this evening. I'm just painting the picture. You originally come from a family farm there. Set the scene for us. Where you are? What's going on?
Yeah, so I'm in a cottage that's usually rented out. So I've been opportunistic and taken a few days here. For a bit of space, and so I'm tuning in from here.
And you can have a fire on and have your feet up at the same time as being on national radio.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Tell us about your short story, Pool Story.
Okay, so it's about a young man. He trained as an actor, but he works in a chip shop, and he likes to frequent the local pool in a small town. So it's a pretty stagnant setup. He's there with the lads. They sort of bob at the end. They overheat in the sauna. And it follows Tim's inner world. He's contemplating his life, his future, and he's got all these stories around him. He's looking at the stories on the wall from the signs, the stories that people are telling him. And then there's a bit of disparity between that and what's actually being said in his environment. And yes, there's a little bit of a subtext where a woman is being blocked from swimming. So it's kind of looking at the parallel between their two stories.
Okay, let's take an extract from Jill's story called Pool Story, and this is read by Nisha Dunbar.
Rural Irish town, evening. Tim drops into the chipper to check his hours, although he knows his hours, then walks past the big Catholic church his mam doesn't make him go to anymore, past the petrol station and glare of red lights with numbers of prices he reads, though he doesn't drive, to the river, where he slows down a fraction to listen to its gurgling. He can already smell the chlorine nearby. His big white shoulders soften. He loves the pool like he loved acting school. Something to do with the space, being there and somewhere else at the same time. Shrubs, car park, swinging doors. He holds it open for a tall woman he doesn't recognise who says, "Thank you very much." The yawning receptionist says, "Hi, Tim." And he says, "Well." It is 8 p.m. Friday. The adults swim at the local leisure centre. Tim doesn't go drinking at the trad on the Thursday evenings. He doesn't go to the gym. In the pool, he doesn't do a length or leave the lads. He likes to float and sometimes does little kicks against the end.
Jill, tell me a little bit about the inspiration for that story. Where does it come from?
Well, firstly, it's just great to hear it and the pacing. He's got a fantastic voice for it. So I'm really interested in human potential and how different spaces have very different narratives of kind of what's possible. And I seem to keep writing inadvertently about women feeling safe in public. And it's a subject that's quite hard to speak about. So I wanted to bring that into the story. And as I said, just sort of looking at the overlap within those themes and masculinity and
Ian, you're a primary school teacher in Talla in Dublin. Did your teaching experience inspire any part of this process of writing this story?
I suppose it did. One of my big inspirations, actually, probably subconsciously, was my niece. Myself and my husband used to take our niece out to for burgers and chips, like the main character, Ivy. Does with her Auntie Ciara, and we had great times with our niece there. She's not based on, Ivy's not based on my niece or anything like that, but and that was certainly an inspiration. But my teaching, definitely, I knew Ivy in my head. I knew what age she was. I knew what class she was in. I could just picture all that. And when I was writing the story, I kept the language very simple. And every sentence I wrote, I read it back, I read it out loud, and I said, would this be in a nine-year-old's syntax or vocabulary? And if it wasn't, I changed it. So it definitely, the experience of teaching and that kind of age range definitely helped, yeah.
How important is writing in your life?
Oh, very important. I've just recently kind of gotten back into the to writing, I suppose, after school. I write pantomimes, actually. Tonight I'm missing our drama group's pantomime rehearsal today, so hopefully they'll forgive me for that. But I write pantomimes with the St Jude's Drama Group in Temple Oak, and I also write with a group of teachers called the Pigwits, and we meet in Drumcondra Education Centre once every month or so, and we all write with a prompt and share our stories at the end, and that's been a great learning experience for me.
I think they might forgive you if you give them a plug for the pantomime and when people...
Yes, it's called it's called Crumb Believable, a Hansel and Gretel pantomime in St Jude's GAA Club in November.
Jill, you're interested in artistic creativity in lots of different forms, art, photography, filmmaking. You're working on your first book at the moment, is that right?
I am, yes, I am. I have funding from the source and I got the National Mentoring Program. So my mentor is Joanna Walsh, which is great. And it's based on a long-term meditation retreat in the Himalayas. So I'm very interested in space and how that connects in how animal nature and different themes. So it's kind of thematic and goes into different threads of a person's life.
Tell me a little bit about that sort of mentoring process and how important it can be to a writer in that stage of their career.
Oh, it's vital. It's really, particularly if you have someone that really understands you. I think at one point I didn't even realize it was thematic, and she said, grab a scissors, we have to cut this out. You write about this and this together, this and this. And if you find the right person, it's very powerful, you know.
Ian, what inspired you to write a short story for this? You obviously write elsewhere and you have written elsewhere. What made you think that the competition might be for you?
Well, I'm a big fan of the competition. I listen back on podcasts through Spotify. Every year I always look at the shortlist. I pick up my own winners and things like that. It's been amazing to be kind of on the other side of it now and be part of it this year. But I did a lot of the work in the last year. I kind of said to myself, I'll give this a shot or whatever. So I read up on my classical short story writers, my Chekhovs and from Chekhov to Claire Keegan, I suppose, and everybody in between, and tried my best to learn the craft, listen to podcasts, listen to the New Yorker podcast, which is a great podcast as well. I took all that, the things that I learned, and tried to put it into the story.
And what about you, Jill, in terms of who inspires you in terms of short story writing?
A lot of the same people, actually. Chekhov is never too far from my desk. Tolstoy, Claire Keegan as well as Hemingway. I seem to go back to that as well. And I think there's something within the Irish vernacular and way of being that really lends itself to the form. So I actually think it suits it quite well.
Well, Jill Kenny and Ian Feary, thank you both for joining us on Arena this evening. A reminder, you can hear Jill's pool story this Wednesday and Ian Feary's Auntie and Anto and Ivy and Ava this Thursday on Late Date here on RTE Radio 1, all of them at 11:20. Now, you can also read or listen to all of the shortlisted stories by going to rte.ie/writing and rte.ie/culture. This Friday, we'll be live in the Pavilion Theatre to announce the winner of this year's RTE Short Story Competition. Those tickets are still available at pavilionthatre.ie. All 10 shortlisted writers will be present, as will the judging panel, Jan Carson, Neil Hegarty and Tristan Rosenstock, and we'll be discussing each of this year's stories and announcing the top prizes. We will also have music on the night from David Kitt in the Pavilion, and here's a little something of what you might expect. And that's David Kitt here on Arena doing You Know What I Want to Know. And he'll be with us this coming Friday night for our live show in the Pavilion Theatre. That is it from tonight's Arena, produced by Reg Luby. Paul Shields was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton. Niall McMonagall was on sound. And that's it for me, Rick O'Shea. Talk to you tomorrow night again between 7 and 8 here on RTE Radio 1 with Tuesday night's Arena. John Creedon is next after the news.